The Honorable Court is now in session. Please be seated and come to order.
Good morning again. The second case for argument is the United States v. De La Torre. Mr. Kubiatowski? Mr. Kubiatowski, is this your first appearance as an appellant?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
I know you're many years on the other at the other table. Well, welcome in your new role.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the government raises two contentions in its appeal. First, that the district court did not have authority to issue its Rule 35, consider a Rule 35 motion, and second, that even assuming that it did have authority to consider that Rule 35 motion, that it erred in granting that motion and reducing the defendant's sentence to 71 months by applying Section 5G1.1A at the outset of the sentencing analysis. Let me first turn to the question of authority. The district court did not have authority to consider the Rule 35 motion for two reasons. First, it was an untimely motion, and second, the district court exceeded the scope of the subject matter in terms of reassessing the combined offense level. With respect to timeliness, to give the court a quick synopsis, the defendant was sentenced on February 2, 2001. 2 months later, on April 10, 2001, the defendant filed the Rule 35C motion. And then, about 5 months later, September 24th, the court granted that motion and reduced the defendant's sentence. This issue really boils down to when imposition of sentence occurs. This court has issued three opinions on that issue. Clay and Wish, which indicate in dicta that entry of judgment and imposition of sentence should be the same date, and also Krillick, in which the court suggested the opposite was the case. The government maintains that imposition of sentence should be interpreted as meaning when sentencing takes place in open court. It's really an issue of statutory construction. It's consistent with all the other rules of criminal procedure and other sentencing statutes, as the government pointed out in its brief. The only reason that you would equate entry of judgment with imposition of sentence is simply for convenience, and the government maintains that you can't do that. You cannot overlook the plain words of the statute, imposition of sentence. There are also, it's consistent with the majority of other circuits that have addressed the issue, and as far as finality, finality has a value. This would serve to end the district court litigation quicker. With respect to subject matter, here, the court went too far. Certainly the government would agree that the court could have vacated the sentence on count one for an Apprendi violation, but what it should have done is simply impose that sentence, cap it at 60 months, and impose it concurrent to the remaining sentences for the other seven counts of conviction. But the court went further. It reconsidered the application of the guidelines. It reconsidered the interplay of Chapter 3 and Chapter 5. It came up with a brand new combined offense level. And the advisory committee notes make it very clear under Rule 35C that Rule 35C was not meant to address issues of guidelines interpretation. And that's exactly what the court did here. So for those two reasons, timeliness and subject matter, the district court did not have authority to grant the Rule 35 motion and reduce the defendant's sentence. The next issue, the next contention that the government makes is with respect to Section 1B1. Assuming that you believe the court did have authority to reduce the sentence, the government maintains that the court erred in reaching the sentence it did, namely 71 months. This is a straightforward issue. It's governed by Section 1B1.1. It goes through the step-by-step approach that you're supposed to take in imposing sentence. First, Chapter 2. You calculate the base offense level and enhancements. Then you move to Chapter 3. you group the related counts and determine an offense level. And keep in mind that the defendant has never objected to the grouping of the counts in this particular case. Then you determine under Chapter 3 whether acceptance of responsibility applies. You apply Chapter 4, determine a criminal history, and then, only then, do you get to Chapter 5. And Chapter 5 dictates how you're supposed to structure the sentence in order to achieve total punishment. Here, the court admitted in the September 24th hearing that it believed Chapter 5 applied for the grouping analysis. And that's where the error occurred. It completely violates the step-by-step approach dictated by Section 1B1.1. With respect to the issues that are raised by the defense in with respect to sentencing, with respect to amounts, firearm, and role, one common strand applies to all these arguments. The district court rejected all three based principally on the fact that the defendant took the stand. The defendant minimized his role. The district court clearly concluded that his testimony was incredible with respect to firearm, with respect to amount, and with respect to his role. And of course, as this court has stated repeatedly, it's virtually never clear error to reject a sentencing argument on the basis of a credibility finding.
I just want to ask you about the Rule 35 issue and the 7-day time period. You rely a lot on Judge Easterbrook's and his comments, but isn't that really dicta? Whereas
yes.
The other two cases are straight, dead, head-on, dealing with the issue of the fact that it's a final sentencing once the order is entered.
Your Honor, I would agree with the first part of the statement that Krillick is dicta. In Krillick, the court did state that the additional hearing exceeded the scope of Rule 35 because it was two or three months later than it should have been, but the court concluded that it was harmless with what the court found there. However, with respect to Claim Wish, in the Wish opinion, the court gave two grounds for finding that the Rule 35 shouldn't have been granted. First, it said it was untimely on either prong, whether or not imposition of sentence was calculated by the date of oral pronouncement or whether it was taken as entry of judgment. But then the court went further. The court also said that it exceeded the scope of Rule 35C and that the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was beyond the scope. With respect to Clay, Rule 35 really didn't apply at all. What happened there, there was a sentence was imposed, and then the court, sua sponte, within the 7-day time limit, agreed to consider an acceptance of responsibility argument. It later vacated that 2 days later, and the defendant filed a second notice of appeal. And the question before the court there really was, do we look at the first notice of appeal or the second notice of appeal? Whether or not the Rule 35C was timed appropriately was not the holding. The holding there was whether or not the fact that a Rule 35C was filed after the initial notice of appeal, whether or not that required or vitiated the first notice of appeal. And the court concluded no. And that's an important point to remember in this case, because if this court does agree that the district court exceeded its authority in granting the Rule 35 motion, the court must still consider the merits of the sentencing issues raised by the defendant, as well as our own argument that the court erroneously reduced the sentence, because otherwise there's still a notice of appeal that's pending from the original sentence of February 2nd. They did file a timely notice of appeal. And if you stop only on that, on the Rule 35 motion, then all these issues will come back to play again. So in brief, all three decisions in the government's interpretation are dicta.
Well, not to be defensive about any of them, Mr. Kubiatowski, because we shouldn't be if they're indefensible. But doesn't Wish say that Clay held? that the imposition of the sentence occurs on the date the judgment is entered by the clerk? I mean, isn't Wish...
I won't contest that it says...
I think Wish's interpretation of Clay is that it's a holding.
I won't contest that that is what Wish said, but looking at the facts of Clay, it really does not power that...
Wish may read Clay, and that's okay for you to say that.
I'll reserve it for me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
But don't say it too strongly.
Not too strongly.
Given who the
author
was.
With some deference.
That's right.
Ms. Gambino.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Chief Judge Flom, Judge Coffey, Judge Williams. With respect to the jurisdiction issue, Wish does say that Clay held that it was 7 days from the entry of judgment. That is the definition of imposition of sentence. And that does make sense as other rules, such as the time running for the notice of appeals, also runs from the entry of judgment. And it makes sense to be consistent in that respect with regard to post-sentencing issues. In addition, not only is there Rule 35C, but as the court in Hensel found, there's an inherent authority of the court to correct an illegal sentence. And what happened in Hensel was that the court, sua sponte, after both the sentencing and the entry of judgment, vacated the sentence to reconsider it, said that they hadn't provided sufficient reasoning for the departure, and then declined to depart. And it's interesting to note that the government in that case supported the court's inherent authority to do this. So they seem to be taking a contrary position here. Also, Krilich is distinguishable because it involves an issue of fact. And what we are talking about here is correcting a legal error. The court did not address the impact of Apprendi on the sentencing of the defendant, and so the reconsideration was in order for the court to do that. So the court had the authority and did not exceed its authority when it readdressed the sentencing, looking at what effect Apprendi had under on Mr. De La Torre's sentence. With respect to the substance of that issue, the court had erred in the first instance because it applied a preponderance of the evidence standard and then imposed a sentence which exceeded the statutory maximum. And it's clear that Chapter 3 and Chapter 5 are to be read consistent with each other. Chapter 5 requires in 5G1.1 that the court consider any statutory maximums and minimums, and in the case where the total punishment or the punishment for each count exceeds the statutory maximum, it's the statutory maximum which applies. In this case, Mr. De La Torre had one substantive count for 35 pounds of marijuana and one conspiracy count, the two drug counts. Under Apprendi, they're required to charge the specific amounts. They did not do that with respect to the conspiracy, and so the statutory maximum for the 35 pounds of marijuana would apply. That gave a statutory maximum of 5 years. So for counts one and for counts two, the court was limited. And it's interesting to note also that the actual guideline for the 35 pounds of marijuana would have resulted in a guideline sentence of 21 to 27 months. Or adding on the 2 points for the firearm, which we dispute, 27 to 33 months. Now, this court has found in several cases, including Westmoreland, that the judge can take by a preponderance of the evidence, the drug amount up until, or the additional relevant conduct up until the statutory maximum, which is what the court did in this case. The court increased from 21 to 27 months to 60 months on both counts one and counts two to account for the additional relevant conduct under the drug charges. With respect to the other counts, those were money laundering counts. And there is no authority for the proposition that you can take the statutory maximum from the money laundering counts, which is higher, and apply that statutory maximum to the drug quantities charged in counts one and two to allow for this greater sentence of 151 months. So what the court did was examine each of the counts as they're required to do when you have a single group, and take the guideline from the highest count, which was the money laundering conspiracy, and that was the 63 to 78 month guideline. And then the court chose a sentence in the mid-range of that guideline and imposed a sentence of 71 months. His analysis was completely consistent with the guidelines, how the guidelines are to be applied, and also with Apprendi, because in order to impose a 151-month sentence, he would be in the position of saying that he was going to exceed the statutory maximum based on a finding by a preponderance of the evidence, and that would not be appropriate. So what the court did in reconsideration was completely in line with the law of Apprendi, and also within his jurisdiction and without exceeding the scope of his authority. Finally, with respect to the cross appeal, the motion to reconsider was limited. It did not exceed any the court's authority to address it. It was limited to the legal issue of the impact of the Apprendi decision on the sentencing. It did not address any of the issues that had been previously addressed and overruled by the court. So if this court were inclined to reverse or remand, as the government requests, based on the Apprendi issue, then we would also ask that we also assert that the court erred when it found the drug amount of over 1,000 kilograms of marijuana applicable to Mr. De La Torre was based on the testimony, well, it wasn't testimony, it was basically the grand jury statements of cooperating informants that went unchallenged at the sentencing hearing. There was no live testimony in support. The defendant did not have an opportunity to challenge the credibility of those informants because the information was presented on paper. So for that reason, we'd ask for reconsideration of the drug amounts. With respect to the firearm, he clearly erred in making the determination that a firearm was enhancement was applicable to Mr. De La Torre. Mr. De La Torre has a disabled right hand. He relied on, again, the grand jury testimony of an informant that was untested, that Mr. De La Torre had carried a gun. And so that application should not have been applied to him. And finally, Mr. De La Torre, in the first instance, was sentenced to drug amounts far and away beyond his actual conduct. And a minor role reduction is intended to be applied to people who are involved in a conspiracy who are held responsible for more than their share, which was clearly the case with Mr. De La Torre. In addition, he was less responsible than his brothers and the others involved in this particular offense. His role was mainly one of transferring money back and forth, and he was not involved in the drug transactions or the scope of the drug transactions that were attributable to his brother. So we would ask for reconsideration of that point as well. And if you have no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kubiadeh.
Counsel discussed Himsel for the basis that the district court has inherent authority to correct a sentence. The government in its brief noted, and I believe correctly so, that any such inherent authority, if the court actually had it, is necessarily superseded by Rule 35C, new Rule 35C. That necessarily constrains that authority, and it constrains it to correcting errors that are either arithmetical, technical, or otherwise clear. And that brings me to Krillick. The defense tried to suggest that Krillick is distinguishable because it involved an issue of fact as opposed to an issue of law. That is not the distinction in Rule 35C. The distinction, Rule 35C applies to any errors. It doesn't matter if it's factual or if legal, provided it's an arithmetical, technical, or otherwise clear error. With respect to Apprendi, keep in mind the timing in this case. The defendant pled guilty on June 8, 2000. 2 weeks later, Apprendi came down. Even at the plea hearing, the defendant knew that the government was going to maintain that he was accountable for 1,000 kilograms of marijuana. The government, after the defendant filed its motion for reconsideration of Rule 35, had always maintained that, yes, there was an Apprendi error with respect to count one, the conspiracy count, which did not allege an amount. However, what the court should have done was simply cap it at 60 months, as required by Apprendi. What it did instead was completely reopen the guidelines issue. Any Apprendi error in this instance was harmless. You have to remember that there are 8 counts of conviction here. 2 drug counts, a conspiracy count, and a substantive distribution, and 8 money laundering counts. 7 that are substantive, 1 that's conspiracy. The sentence for any one of those money laundering counts, the statutory max was up to 20 years. The sentencing guideline range here was 151 to 188 months. That range was well within the statutory maximum, so any Apprendi error was harmless. Finally, the defense mentioned that there was no authority for sentencing him on the basis of the drug guidelines as opposed to the money laundering guidelines. And the government respectfully disagrees. Griffith is the authority for that proposition. In Griffith, there were 3 counts of conviction. There was a money laundering count and 2 RICO counts. The money laundering count dictated, powered the offense level, but it was capped at a certain point. But as a result of the combined offense level with the 2 RICO counts, he was effectively sentenced more than the statutory max for money laundering. And that's exactly what's happening here. You don't have a statutory max. You have Apprendi that's capping the 1 offense level. But what Griffith noted and what applies here is that there are multiple counts of conviction. And Chapter 5 of the guidelines was promulgated in order to dictate to the district courts, this is how you should structure the sentences in order to achieve total punishment. We're talking multiple counts of conviction, and that means the penalties are going to be more severe. With respect to relief, the government is requesting that the original sentence of 151 months be reinstated, or that if the case is remanded for resentencing, that the district court resentence within that guidelines range. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I yield the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.